This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. In which Jay Powell kind of leaves you cold. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 16th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know that thing where you're waiting and waiting and waiting for something to happen, and then it happens and you're like, that's it? That's kind of the way Fed Chair Jay Powell's press conference went today. I mean, there was never going to be an interest rate increase out of this meeting, and it's not like he was going to say, "Oh boy, that inflation, did you see that? That's really bad." But somehow, I expected more.
This is an extraordinarily unusual time, and we really don't have a template or any experience of a situation like this.
I mean, that much we kind of knew. Right. Powell did say inflation's going to be a bit higher than the Fed had been thinking for a bit longer, maybe as well. Also, their big bond buying program, they are no longer, to quote Powell from a couple of months ago, not even talking about cutting back. Here he is today.
But you can think of this meeting that we had as the talking about meeting, if you like. And I now suggest that we retire that term, which has served its purpose well, I think.
I kind of liked it. I don't know why it bugs him a little bit. I don't know. Powell was, though, going on bullish on the American labor market.
There's every reason to think that we'll be in a labor market with very attractive numbers, with low unemployment, high participation, and rising wages across the spectrum.
So that's the upshot of the Fed meeting today. But it is handy, actually, that Chair Powell said that about the labor market, because we have spent every single month since the start of this pandemic picking apart jobs numbers and unemployment claims. But there's a lot happening in the labor force that doesn't get captured in that data, right? Like the toll that long-term unemployment during a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic can take, and how that long-term unemployment is creating a less predictable back-to-work economy. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
Bea Lederman's daughter has an autoimmune disease. So when the Virginia high school where she teaches computers and coding mandated that teachers come back to work last August, she quit.
I really thought I could find something, even if it was part-time employment.
She applied to software companies that work with schools, but she has no sales experience. She applied to teach Spanish, which she's taught before, no bites. She applied to jobs that have nothing to do with computers or teaching, like an hourly position at the DMV.
I really lost hope. You just have so much time with just your thoughts, and it eats you up.
Losing a job is already isolating, says Art Goldsmith, an economist at Washington and Lee University. And now there's the isolation of the pandemic itself.
That has created a lot of poor mental health, more so in this recession than in previous recessions.
Long-term unemployment changes how people feel about their worth as workers. Sarah Damaschke is a sociologist at Penn State. Before the pandemic, she followed people who lost their jobs.
By the 12-month mark, they were describing themselves as having fewer and fewer jobs that they felt that they were qualified for.
This can create a pattern. Someone gets a job below their skill level, or one that has nothing to do with their skills. They're unhappy and leave, or are let go because they were never a good fit. And then they're back out there searching.
it's devastating for their career in the long run. Each time they scramble and find something and fail, they fall further and further behind.
That's not the case for Bea Lederman. Next month, she'll start teaching computer classes again. But the new job comes with a compromise. The commute is 50 miles each way. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
That's a long way. Sorry, one more quick thing on Powell and the Fed. Remember yesterday we told you about the dot plot, kind of a graph showing where individual members of the Federal Open Market Committee and presidents of the regional Fed banks think interest rates are going to be in the near-term future. Here is Powell on the dots today.
The dots are not a great forecaster of future rate moves, and that's not because it's just because it's so highly uncertain. There is no great forecaster of future dots. So dots to be taken with a big grain of salt.
Noted, Mr. Chairman, but why do they do them then? On Wall Street today, equities were kind of lukewarm on the Fed. The yield on the 10-year spiked. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One thing Chair Powell didn't really say anything about today was housing, not like we need him to. Home prices are rising, lots of people are looking to buy, and there's not enough supply to meet demand. How much supply are we missing, though? Well, I'm glad you asked. A report out today from the National Association of Realtors says we're short about 6.8 million new housing units. And that one big reason for that is that construction of new housing, especially new homes that are affordably priced, has slowed a bunch in the past 20 years. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on the housing desk today.
Housing has been getting less and less affordable for years now, both for renters and for buyers.
The short story is that we simply haven't been producing enough housing.
Daniel McHugh is at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard. He says that was especially true during and after the Great Recession, when construction of new homes and apartments dropped way off. And since then,
the housing that we have been producing has been focused on the high end,
rather than on smaller and medium-sized homes and apartments. Another lasting effect of the Great Recession is that there are fewer people working in construction now, says Jenny Schutz at the Brookings Institution.
There was kind of a generation of people who would have gone into carpentry and plumbing and become electricians who just didn't go into that because construction shut down.
And it's taking a while to build that labor force back up. There are also fewer places to build new housing these days, Schutz says, at least in the areas where people want to live.
We've seen an increasing interest of people in living closer into city centers, particularly in a handful of metro areas that have really hot labor markets. But those are places that have made it very difficult to build new housing.
Because many of them have strict zoning regulations that only allow for single-family homes or a certain level of density that's already been reached. And on the demand side, there are a lot more people looking to buy, Schutz says, because millennials are getting married and having kids and making more money.
And so you've got this huge generation that's suddenly ready to buy homes and expand the amount of space they're living in. And the flip side of that is that baby boomers are staying in their homes longer.
Add all that up, and there just isn't enough housing, new or old, to go around. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
We talk about economic indicators all the time, right? Your straight-ahead ones and the less obvious ones like music festivals. Concerts and festivals are happening again. Only problem is the supply chain for a lot of musical instruments, guitars for us today, just can't keep up. Adam Levin runs the family business. It's Chuck Levin's Music Center out of Wheaton, Maryland.
March was like one of the most stressful times ever. And they shut us down March 23rd, a day that I'll never forget. I grabbed my computer and I went home and we were there for 3 months. You know, my initial thought was, well, people are going to need food and shelter. Like, they're not going to want to buy guitars. And what we realized was that when everyone's stuck at home, there's only so much Netflix you can watch. There's only so much, you know, video games you can play. People that hadn't played in a while wanted to play something. People were looking at the guitar in their closet and being like, man, I want to play this thing. I need a new set of strings. Like, whatever it was. About a week later, we realized we need to ship stuff out. Like, people want their stuff, and we have tons of it. Guitars and keyboards were the thing that everyone wanted. Guitars and keyboards and recording stuff was just like, if you had it, it was gone, and you couldn't get any more because the logistics of it all just completely got obliterated. And the thing about guitars is a lot of it's finished by hand. The machines can get it most of the way, but someone's got to touch this thing. Someone's got to make sure the neck is not completely messed up. The cool thing about music is that, like, it's the whole world. Parts come from Asia or Mexico or Europe or whatever to complete these things. If the factory in China shuts down, there's going to be problems. For just a day, there's going to be problems. They were shut down for months. We're buying more stuff because we have to have the stuff more than I normally would stock, because it used to be, I'll sell what I need, I'll buy it, it'll be here in a week, and I'll just keep rolling through it. Well, now it's like, I need to buy as much as I can, because I don't know when I'm going to get the next thing. As professional musicians come back, as schools come back, so now there's an even bigger pull and strain on the stuff that's happening right now. But there's literally boats waiting in the water outside the port with gear on it, ready to be, it's here, but it's just not coming in. A year later, it's still the same thing. There are back orders now that won't come till next year. The second I open the doors here, I got to have 60 people in the building instead of the 5 it took me to ship boxes. But people want to come in.
Adam Levin, he's the proprietor of Chuck Levin's Music Center in Wheaton, Maryland. Hey, you know that podcast that Molly Wood and I do? Make Me Smart, it's called. Well, we got a newsletter too, you know. You can check it out, subscribe, do all that good stuff. Marketplace.org/newsletters. Coming up.
It comes down to more of a political show.
What's that? Congress and the economy? Political? Nah. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials, down 265 points today, 0.7%, 34,033. NASDAQ fell 33 points, 0.2%, 14,039. The S&P 500 dipped 22 points, about 0.5%, 42,023. The furniture maker with its headquarters at, and I'm not making this up, 1 Lazy Boy Drive in Monroe, Michigan, on the western edge there of Lake Erie, reported quarterly earnings and revenue above expectations, but supply chain issues and price increases for raw materials were adding up. Lazy Boy shares reclined, down more than 11%. I love my job. Industrial and construction supplies company Fastenal is HQ'd in the Mississippi River town of Winona, Minnesota. It sells everything from abrasive to lubricants and, you know, fasteners of various kinds. Stock was downgraded by Morgan Stanley. Shares down 1% today. General Motors says it's going to spend $35 billion developing electric and autonomous vehicles through 2025. GM shares up 1.5% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note up to 1.57%. Still ridiculously low, but that's a big jump from pre-Powell. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Time now for a story that we are going to call Sabri Goes for a Walk. In New York and California and a bunch of other states as well, yes, but those are the two economic biggies. In New York and California, masks are off, distancing rules aren't rules anymore, and crowd sizes are big. So in our news meeting this morning, Sabri said, hey, what if I just walk around New York City and talk to people, see what they say? And we said, okay.
There was a time when 9th Avenue in Midtown was empty and silent, except for sirens, every few minutes, all day and all night. Today, it could not be busier. At this gym in Midtown, they've started to scrape away the stickers on the floor where people used to wait in line, 6 feet apart.
There's no more need for these stickers here.
Kevin Sung works the front desk.
I mean, like, for business-wise, business has been booming. Everyone's feeling safer to come back.
A block away, there's a high school where Sandra Portella is a speech therapist.
And honestly, the rent in a lot of places went down throughout the city. So yeah, I'm definitely doing really well.
But one of the hallmarks of the pandemic has been the fact that different people have processed and experienced risk in different ways. And that has not changed. 19-year-old Cressy Mills was waiting for the E-train to take her to her job with the city. She's not vaccinated and wears a mask.
I mean, I feel like it's moving too fast. Like, I feel like seeing people outside with no mask, and they really don't care. Like, people would just walk into my job and no mask, and they're smiling. I'm like, why are you smiling? You should be wearing your mask.
Businesses can, and sometimes do, still require masks. The inconsistency frustrates people like Christy Saxton.
You know, they're confusing everybody. One place saying you don't, then another place you get to, they be like, oh, no, you have to put your mask on or no service. It's annoying.
A lot of offices are still not open, but this park on 50th Street is packed with people on lunch break. William DeVellas is there. He's a chef. His industry is seeing a serious labor shortage.
So there's a lot of places that are offering like really ridiculous amounts of money to just get people come back to work. There's a place on 42nd Street that's offering people $18 just to flip burgers.
Gabriel Marquez is a waiter at a Peruvian restaurant a few blocks away. They've actually opened a second restaurant closer to Times Square.
You know, this is my life. This is my business. And now I feel like everything that I've been through was worth it. We survived, and now we're ready for the future.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Walking around the streets of New York or wherever you like, actually, you can get us on a podcast too. You know, check it out, marketplace.org or your favorite platform. True story. We had an extended family thing the other night. Everybody's vaxxed, and it was really nice to get together. There were burgers and cold beer. But anyway, at one point, my 25-year-old nephew, I think he's 25, he's headed to graduate school this fall, and he looks at me and he says, hey, Kai, where do you think the economy's going anyway? And I said, well, inflation, blah, 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 the Fed, yada, 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 pent-up demand and supply chains. Regular listeners among you will know what I said. But I tell you that because there are people who do economic forecasting professionally. And right now, that is a tough line of work. Ellen Zentner is chief U.S. economist at Morgan Stanley, one of those professional economic forecasters. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Scale of 1 to 10, how much harder is it now for you to forecast this economy than it was like a year and a half ago?
Oh, gosh. Can I go above 10?
Yes, you may. Yes, you may.
You know, we had such steady growth in the last cycle that at one point, if we just turned in a forecast for 200,000 in monthly payroll gains, we would have been just about as accurate as any of the fancy statistical models would have been. In this cycle, we've pretty much had to scrap all models and just try to scrape together forecasts based on anecdotal evidence.
This maybe I'm exaggerating. I don't know. I mean, I have this image of forecasters, obviously you among them, kind of licking your finger and sticking it up and trying to figure out which way the wind blows. What do you look at as you try to, and I guess this is probably a pejorative word with forecasters, as you try to guess what's going to happen? What are you looking at?
It is a lot more complicated than lick your finger and stick it in the air, although sometimes I do make jokes at my own expense. But when models just don't make sense, you have to really go back to the drawing board, almost get out your abacus to try to figure things out. And so one thing that really helped was media outlets. So last year when the economy was shutting down, you know, we went state by state, scraped the media reports and started putting out estimates that way and in order to try to get a handle of how many millions of people were losing their jobs.
And I imagine you're also using some of the things we talked about in a story we did on high frequency data, right? You're using time card data and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know, this is interesting. Whereas we were making baby steps toward adopting daily frequency data before, we sort of were hurtled into adopting it. So using OpenTable to see if people were making bookings to dine out more, how many Google searches for directions were happening. We've really had to adopt almost overnight. And I think it's opened the door to a whole new exciting element for economic forecasting. And importantly, I think something that's going to continue to attract those youngsters that are just now entering the labor force, attract them to the field.
How much, and look, I will say this only because you raised the subject, right? You've been doing this for a while, and you have some experience and you've got a track record. How valuable was it for you to be able to look at something that was completely off the mark in, you know, September of last year or December or even like January, February this year and say, you know what, that doesn't look right and we need to figure out another way to get this data or to figure out what it means?
Yeah, so I think there's that reminder, right, that you can juniorize teams, but when disaster strikes, you need experienced economists on the team that have lived through it. Now, I'm not saying I've lived through a pandemic. I'm not that old, Kai, but but I lived through the financial crisis as a practicing economist, and that was really the first time that models didn't make sense in my practicing years. And having lived through that, then I was able to quickly recognize when the models just were not going to be helpful. And then, of course, having hindsight, we're able to recognize when you were wrong and dig into why you were wrong. And then that's how you build on that as a learning experience for the next crisis.
Ellen Zentner is the chief U.S. economist at Morgan Stanley. Ellen, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
Hey, here's something we haven't talked about in a while. The debt limit. Congress and the White House do a little dance every couple of years where Congress has to vote to lift or suspend the total amount of debt the government is allowed to run up. They always do let it run up, but only after a whole lot of drama. The latest suspension of the limit, currently set at $28.1 trillion, expires on July 31st. And once again, shockingly, this thing is a cliffhanger. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look at how we got here.
The history of the debt limit starts with World War I. It's 1917. The U.S. declares war on Germany, then has to figure out how to pay for it. So Congress passes legislation allowing the Treasury Department to borrow money by selling war bonds to investors and the American public.
Motion picture stars arrive in Washington to aid in the nation's campaign to sell war bonds.
Treasury was free to sell the bonds as long as the borrowing didn't go over a certain amount, a debt limit. Before this, Treasury had to go running to Congress for approval every time it wanted to borrow money. Shai Akabis says it got to be a pain in the neck. He's an economist at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
And the debt limit was effectively a way that Congress could set an overall limit and then let the Treasury Department issue debt as they needed.
Now, a higher debt limit does not mean funding more government programs.
It is not new spending that we are incurring as a result of raising the debt limit. It's just paying the bills that are already due.
But if those bills stack up, rising higher than the debt limit Congress set, lawmakers have to do one of two things: raise the limit or suspend it for a certain period of time. Laura Blessing is a senior fellow at Georgetown University.
Historically, this has normally been done with very little fanfare. These have not normally been battle royales in Congress and in our politics.
But over the past three decades, the debt ceiling began sparking political battles over federal spending. Then came 2011, and
a very empowered number of fiscal hardliners in the House Republican Conference who say, look, you know, we're not voting for any tax raises, period, the end.
Blessing says in 2011, Congress barely raised the debt ceiling in time to prevent the U.S. from defaulting on its debts. So where are we with a debt limit now? Well, Congress suspended it for 2 years back in 2019 when it stood at almost $22 trillion. That suspension expires at the end of this July, so Congress doesn't have much time to suspend the debt ceiling again or raise it. This is a movie Lindsay Piegza has seen before. She's chief economist at Stifel Financial.
It comes down to more of a political show as opposed to a legitimate tactic to rein in government spending.
Piegza says she expects more brinksmanship, but Congress will again raise or suspend the debt limit because the alternative to default is unthinkable. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which should not, repeat not, be taken as a negative reflection on my boss or my boss's boss or anybody up the chain to corporate HQ. Glassdoor is out with its annual report on the top CEOs in this economy, the top 100 to be specific, rated by their employees. Rich Lesser at Boston Consulting Group is in the number one spot. Who's not there? Half the population, only five women on the whole list. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context. Comes to us today from Restaurant Business Magazine, which is, to be clear, an in-house restaurant industry publication, so know your source. But I did think this was interesting. Citing Census Bureau data, the magazine points out that after a year and whatnot of this pandemic, we are back to spending more money at restaurants than we spend at grocery stores. So that's an indicator. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Jace Siebold, Liana Squillace, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. Remember, they're the ones coming in, so the rest of us don't have to. Although soon, I guess we all will be, eventually. Don't know. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.